wait for the blue light. There it is. Okay.
All right. So, calling to order the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development for Wednesday, May 27th, 2015. On tap today, we have a couple of different information meetings. So let's begin with the DMV Service Transformation Program. So I'll open a public hearing on that. And Tom McClellan, please.
So, Vice Chair Gorsuch, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom McClellan. I'm the DMV Administrator with the Department of Transportation. I'm here to give you a brief informational overview on our service transformation program at DMV. Last session, 2014, the legislature formed a customer service task force. I think you were actually a member of that committee.
Yes.
The primary recommendation of that group, when they looked at all the possible ways to improve the efficiency and effectiveness of customer service, was to replace these very old computer systems that DMV's been using. The task force benefited from a tour of a DMV field office and a tour of our headquarters building. Since everyone can't see our back office operations, we did create a short video I'd like to show you, just to give a sense, a taste, a feel of what goes on in the back office at DMV.
Each morning, staff members at ODOT's DMV headquarters receive, open, sort, and route about 100,000 documents, such as vehicle titles and forms, in a paper-intensive and time-consuming process. In a typical day, DMV archives 47,000 documents using ancient microfilm machines. 850 DMV employees spread across 60 field offices, headquarters, and call centers serve thousands of daily customers and answer thousands of phone calls per day, all while using tools that are archaic by computer standards. And it's not just ODOT employees and customers who have to deal with these legacy systems. DMV daily receives 20,000 convictions, suspensions, and other actions by courts, data vital to law enforcement officers, but using court technology first designed in 1966. Today, DMV programmers still work with ancient programming languages like COBOL to maintain applications written nearly a half century ago. It's a time-consuming and expensive process to make even simple improvements and updates mandated by changes in state and federal driver licensing and vehicle laws. And none of these applications are capable of connecting to today's mobile devices. Further, the skill set for maintaining and updating DMV's computer system is an endangered species. 40% of DMV's information systems crew is eligible to retire today, and most of the rest in 5 years. For these and many other reasons, it's vital for Oregon to upgrade its DMV systems soon. It's more than a computer upgrade. DMV needs to modernize the way it serves its customers and in the ways today's customers expect. Here are some examples of what we'd like to accomplish. More transactions available online, which are now done in the field office or by mail. Mobile device access and transactions. More convenient and faster service for customers. More efficient and accurate completion of transactions. And ongoing system updates that are faster, simpler, and less expensive. DMV can be successful with this program, which will affect every area of the organization. Currently, mountains of documents travel back and forth at DMV headquarters as they go from section to section for processing. In the future, electronic bits and bytes will replace paper on metal carts, ushering driver and vehicle records at the speed of light. It isn't as easy as installing a new software program, though. The DMV will have to clean up a lot of old records contained on microfilm, microfiche, and in outdated computer databases. Chunked up in manageable parts over nearly a decade, DMV's service transformation program will overhaul processes and systems born in the 1960s and bring them into the 21st century with online capability, improved service, more convenience, fewer trips to DMV offices, and be more efficient in making future updates and improvements to our services.
Sometimes a picture is worth a thousand words.
Yes.
There's a thousand words that come to mind, I'm sure, when you see that. And we are fast, but not quite that fast.
I was going to say, that's very impressive. That looks like the pizza box guy in those commercials.
The legislature in 2012, I think, recognized at that time that there was a need to start doing some planning to replace these old computer systems and the business processes that are tied to those. Some funding was approved in the short session in 2012 to start some planning. And so we've been working from that for quite some time. We hired a consultant about 2 years ago, took a real in-depth look at our technology, did a gap analysis for us, did a peer review of other states and their experiences and what they have done. And really laid out for us a roadmap to modernize our computer systems, recommending that we take as many as 9 to 10 years, not do it all at one time, big yeah. bang, just do it gradually in chunks and be successful in that way. The business case that we've come to is that we can't serve customers as well as we'd like, largely because of the tools that we provide to our employees and for our customers to utilize. People typically think of DMV as a place individuals go to do their personal DMV business. However, DMV is also a key business partner for many different entities. And their business operations improvement efforts are often hindered by our computer systems and the way we do business. Examples, and there are several there on that screen, law enforcement. Changes to driver records are made daily by the thousands, but they're typically a day or two behind the time because of the batch processing that takes place. It's not a real-time, you know, update. Hmm. It's at least overnight as far as updating our computer system. So law enforcement on the side of the road is getting data that isn't as current as it probably could be. Local government has access to our data. However, it's difficult to establish the connectivity and to use that that information once it's available. If it was available and easier to use, we anticipate they could be more efficient with their enforcement activities, parking, disabled placards, abandoned vehicles, you know, things that they need information from us. They could do a lot more and better service that they provide in their own local communities. Another example is financial institutions and vehicle dealers. Many would like to have the ability to do what's called electronic liens and titles, where you can record your ownership, you can record security interest electronically, with paper being an option, but not the primary way of recording that interest or that ownership or change in ownership over time. Many states are able to do that electronically. We do it with paper and updates to our computer systems. Enabling old systems to do those types of things is both costly and time-consuming to do. So what we're looking for is more modern technology to be able to provide those types of services. DMV of the future, there's a number of things that we're moving from and to over time. But remember, DMV is the face of state government. Most Oregonians over the age of 16 will have some experience with DMV. They move to the state of Oregon. You frequently find yourself working with DMV to change your title, get stickers, get a driver's license or an ID card. So almost every person in Oregon at some point ends up with some contact with us. And we recognize that's an important responsibility we have. Things we need to move away from are that waiting in line in field offices and provide more opportunities for people to do things from the comfort of their home, you know, online, or with self-service kiosks, potentially. We're very paper-centric, which is error-prone. So real-time automated systems are definitely the way we need to be going in the future. Inflexible systems are kind of part of the technology that we're using. We need to be able to adapt to the changing needs that come about. And that includes legislation from this body and from the federal government, being able to adapt to those new requirements that come about. We constrain our business partners. We want to enable them to do things and continuously improve over time. There are four main program goals for us: service excellence, efficiency, to be accountable in the way we go about this, and to modernize both our technology and our business processes. The benefits we see are improved customer service. We are definitely a customer service type of an organization. We have to, because of that public contact that we have. Increased efficiency, better flexibility. Fraud protection, fraud prevention is another part of what we do. So having those systems that are checking identity and who someone is when they're trying to do business with us, we need better tools, you know, for that type of thing. We're planning to follow a strategy, really, that includes what we call a program of manageable projects. Breaking into pieces, here's where that 9 to 10 years comes in. We take our time. Not that these pieces aren't pretty good size. There's still a lot of work to be done. But rather than try to do everything all at one time, we want to do it in manageable chunks over time. The initial years will be on some foundational and base type systems, things like data warehousing, imaging, get away from that microfilm, you know, readers that you were just looking at, the feeding the paper in. and get to imaging, and that will really transform the way we do business with the public and our business partners. We are developing a more detailed schedule to complete this work once we have a vendor on board. That's the first step for us, is to prepare an RFP, solicit a company that can really help us with this. We'll be looking to companies that have been successful elsewhere with this type of work. That will largely be what we're doing in this next couple of years, is all that readiness work, preparing our organization for that type of change that is coming. While the program does have a heavy, technology component, a primary goal is service transformation, hence the name, Service Transformation Program. Similar to the gains that have been made over time from the era of rotary phones, where you're attached to the wall and can only do certain things, mm-hmm. today you've got your smartphones. You're walking around. They're walking computers, and the things that you can do today are just amazing. We're not able to take advantage nearly as much as we would like to with that type of technology. For someone to be able to do a vehicle registration renewal or a driver license replacement, pay your reinstatement fees, those types of things, if you could just do that from your phone, it's not unheard of, unthinkable in this day and age to do those types of things. So we need to be able to enable that kind of potential. So as we are doing the transformation, we're looking at process improvement, employee training, change management. So it's not just the technology. The people that are using it need to be able to adapt to those changes over time.
Mr. McClellan, I would imagine at some point we would get to where you could actually have your driver's license, if you didn't have the physical driver's license, that you could pull it up on your smartphone.
Vice Chair Gorsuch, there actually are a couple of states that are pursuing that pretty aggressively. Iowa in particular has put that forward as a concept mm-hmm. to get to the point where, like you have with your insurance policy, you can pull
right.
up a smartphone.
Right.
It serves as evidence of insurance. There's a lot of things to work through, though, when you get into an identity document like a driver's
right.
license.
Yeah.
So a lot of issues need to be worked through.
Right.
But we've got a couple of states out there in the forefront, so we're watching that pretty closely to see what they end up with.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Just four quick things here, ways to identify and to mitigate risk over time. For us, it's learning from the past. If you've been around a while here in Oregon, you probably know that DMV had an unsuccessful attempt at this about 20 years ago. It's taken us almost that long. It has taken us that long to get back on the horse and have the courage to come back and ask you for the funding to move ahead. But those old systems from the late 80s, early 90s are even older than they were then. So it's time for us to get on the horse and ride along and start replacing those systems and get up with the more modern times for us. So learning from the past, learning from other agencies' failed and successful attempts at this. And there are plenty of failed attempts. And so there's a lot to be learned, from those experiences. The Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators were a part of that. So other state DMVs around the country and in Canada has an association. They formed a working group on system modernization. So we'll be watching very closely what they come up with as best practices, advice to states as they embark upon something like this. One of the things we did get out of our experience from 20 years ago was some pretty rigorous project management capabilities. I put any of our project managers to anybody else in the state as far as their ability to lead a project. Mm-hmm. And so in the governance that we have around projects and the running of projects, I think it's very solid. So as we head into something big like this, we can rely on that as a core capability basically for us as we move ahead. And of course, communication is mm-hmm. vital, both internally and externally, as we move along. We do have a budget request. It's in the Transportation Subcommittee of Ways and Means. What we're looking for from the legislature is the expenditure authority to move ahead, some positions in FTE, and that funding will help us with some contracts to bring in that professional expertise that we need. Mm-hmm. This isn't necessarily one of our expertise areas, develop systems like this. So let's bring in the people who do know how to do this and rely on them to help us through this. So we'll be completing our readiness activities, procuring a vehicle title and registration system as one of our first systems we need to replace. That's where a big chunk of the money we collect is through title and registration work. It's one of our older systems as well. We want to launch what we're calling an online transaction center, or DMV2U, capability where you can log on with your user ID and password and information about you, your driver's license, your vehicles, perhaps your record that you might want to order, your personal record, things like update information with us, notices potentially, like a suspension notice or a reminder about a license or a registration expiring. There's a lot of different capabilities if we can tailor that to the individual. To get to that point, we've got to reconfigure our data so it's all around the customer and not separate. We'll be following the state's CIO's stage gate process as we move ahead as well. So there's some checkpoints, milestones that we'll have to hit as we move along. This is more for show than anything else. This is a diagram of our vehicle titling process. As you can see, it's pretty complicated. There's a lot of feedback loops, a lot of checks and double checks of things, largely because it is paper-based manual processes. So it's, I'll admit, it's more for the effect than anything else. No reason for you to try to read that. But it is very complicated. It typically takes us, our goal is 19 days to produce a title, and we're in about the 24 to 25 days range right now for the staffing and the volumes that we're dealing with. The way to cut that back to get to the point where it's just a few days to produce a title is with technology. It's more of a streamlined view of a vehicle, you know, title and registration process. We want to move from paper to electronic applications, have information verified and records updated electronically, potentially have users pick from a list of options. If they're doing something online, they pick options of things and pull down menus, things that are not that innovative these days but should be available for people as they're doing online services with us. A number of process improvement goals that we've set here. Increase accuracy of the work we do, improve revenue collection. We are an important revenue collection, you know, source for the State Highway Fund and for local government to be able to do that as efficiently as we possibly can and bring money in for the state's transportation system. We're building in accountability as we move along. Part of that is the governance, the approach that you manage this kind of an effort over time. We plan to form in the next few months an external strategic advisory committee that would likely have, you know, members of this body, legislators that would sit on that, maybe some private sector technology, you know, experts that we can rely on, some customers, some business key stakeholders, really, that we work with, and the Department of Administrative Services. We want to have, you know, an inclusive, kind of transparent approach here so that people are hearing our current status, hearing from a third-party, you know, quality assurance vendor, any unvarnished, you know, information they might have as far as things are going. So it's not running through the agencies, going directly to a committee that's digging in a little deeper and learning about what we're doing. We'll have our own steering committees, and we have internally what we call our user council, our senior managers at DMV that are watching over these projects and getting regular reports. Probably should point also out in the state's stage gate process for the state CIO, we have passed the first stage. We've gotten at least through the business case part and are moving on to the next phases of that. Just got approval for that early this month. So just in closing, this slide reminds us that the DMV staff are committed to service excellence. Unfortunately, the tools we provide kind of hold them back from doing the things they would like to be able to do even more. We're doing our homework. We're setting a vision, planning for success. We're communicating as transparently as we possibly can and doing all we can to identify and mitigate risks of something as risky as this moving ahead. But with support from our key stakeholders, from you, members of this body, legislature, we're prepared to move this program forward. And with a compelling and a detailed plan at the right time that has action items and to really transform the service provided by DMV. So with that, I'd take any questions that you have.
Okay. Any questions?
I have one.
Yes.
Well, I appreciate your detailed update. And, you know, you said it right out front, and that is that, you know, we've got to have checks and balances to make sure that if we're doing contracts with outside folks, we've got to make sure we understand their abilities, their capabilities, and make sure that our bid document or our procurement document is really specific about times, dates, and product.
Deliverables.
And so, you know, what do you think you have in the way of support for doing that, you know?
Vice Chair Gorsuch, Representative McLean, I think our procurement staff is quite expert in putting those contracts together. We've learned from others that you don't do time and materials contracts. You do deliverables-based contracts. You utilize contractors to watch contractors sometimes. So you have a third party, an independent review of what's going on and the quality of what they're doing. where risks are identified early, mm-hmm. and you listen to those and take action on those. You don't just set it on a shelf. Thank you very much. You actually read it. You take some action and mitigate those risks as you move along. So procurement-wise, I think we have some very good staff that know how to do procurement, how to build contracts that never ironclad, but at least are as solid as you possibly can get. Mm-hmm. And like I said, build it on the deliverables, the products that you can review and approve before you move on to the next part.
Can I ask one?
Oh, yeah.
I really liked your idea of parceling it out, mm-hmm. you know, and not making it this, you know, like the Cover Oregon big thing. It has to be done in like 2 years and it's all has to be done. But the whole idea of just having it in pieces and mm-hmm. take the first piece that you really need to modernize first and make it easier for your staff. Right. And then take the second piece and take on another titles or whatever. I think that's really extraordinarily bright. And you gave me two really good suggestions there on things that you're thinking about as far as how you review contracts and manage contracts. And to me, that's the whole name of the game. You can pick the right vendor. You can pick somebody who can really produce the products that you want. But sometimes you just have to manage it in such a way that it really gets to where you want at the right time. Right. So, but thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative
Blindley. Vice Chair Gorsuch, thank you for the presentation and your efforts and work. So one of the things that I hear a lot before I got here and still hear from the general public is costs and what things end up costing versus what we think they're going to cost. This, if I read this correctly, the key part of this is $90 million, but the project actually is over 10 years potentially. And so I'd like to understand, so both the confidence level of those figures and what's in place. Since this is going to be stretched out over multiple years to achieve this, what's in place to ensure that mm-hmm. We track that and are somewhere in the ballpark when we get to the other end?
Vice Chair Gorsuch and Representative Lively, the $90 million figure came from the consultant we hired a couple years ago. So as they looked at the state of our computer systems, which they incidentally said were frozen in time and basically need to be replaced completely, their best estimate was that $90 to $100 million, actually the number that they provided to us in total over that 9 to 10 year period. So what we're asking for now is a first phase. $30 million is actually what we have in our budget request that would cover most of expenses over about a 3 year period. We're watching very closely to other states as they do similar types of procurements, what they're paying for vehicle systems, for driver systems, and some are doing both simultaneously. And it appears that we're still in the ballpark with the estimate that we have today. We're pretty prudent in the way we spend money, a lot of controls in place. We anticipate there'll be quite a bit, actually, of oversight by this body, by your legislative fiscal office, and certainly by the state CAO's office to monitor our progress and to ensure that we're not spending at a higher burn rate than we can afford over time and watching the results as they come along. So I think it's the rigor, it's the process, the governance, as I talked about, having people that are really watching this as we move along, and the controls that you can put into contracts, those types of things.
I understand and believe that there's reasons for people to be suspect based on the past history of not just your department but others, and most recent history, in fact, of what we thought we were doing from a computers or technology and what we ended up doing and what we got for that money. Mm-hmm. And my biggest concern is just the time frame involved versus the fact that it's $90 or $100 million necessarily when it goes that long, and how quickly technology changes mm-hmm. and things do. And it provides some comfort that you're looking at what other people are doing mm-hmm. where the technology is at. But I just have to be, I'm somewhat cautious on saying that in 10 years we won't have spent a whole bunch more money and technology will have changed so much that we may have changed our course a couple times. Mm-hmm. But we have to do it. Don't get me wrong. I understand that we've got to go down this path.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Other questions? Well, I would just say that having worked a long time ago in law enforcement, when these systems were fairly new, I can tell you that this is not just something that is productive for customer service, but the law enforcement function is extremely mm-hmm. important. And there is nothing worse than going to check someone and finding that not only is DMV down, but LEDS, the state system for law enforcement, is down as well. So things that we can do to move that along, very, very good. And it sounds like then you're starting with about a third of the funding in terms of the request that you have up front. Is that correct?
Yes, that $30 million would be about a third of what we're thinking overall. The vehicle system is big. It's an important one for us to get right. A lot of transactions, a lot of titles, vehicle-type transactions. Like I said, the revenue part of it is a key part as well. Okay. We've seen some vendor presentations where they're sharing, you know, what they have and they installed in other states, and the mouth just starts to salivate.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And with my budget background, the accounting capabilities and the financial capabilities are just incredible compared to what we offer today. Point-of-sale systems that, you know, actually tell our folks how much to collect from somebody, not just knowing your head. This plus this plus this means you collect this much money from the person, but the system actually tells you that and kicks out a receipt when you provide your credit card to do the payment.
Ah, another, yes,
an
a credit card,
as well.
A debit card, right,
yes.
All right, well, if there's nothing further, thank you so much. Oh, yeah.
I just had one. It seems like everywhere we go with technology, the first thing that we hear after the system is in place is, how are you doing on privacy issues? You know, and what are your walls as far as protecting privacy of individuals and their personal information?
Yeah.
So you talked about the smartphone, and I thought about pulling it up, and I thought, well, who could pull it up?
Right.
You know, and so it just seems like you better have a contingency fund for privacy issues at the end of the building of the system.
Yeah, Representative McLean, that is always a concern for us, is security and the protection of the private personal information that we are responsible for keeping, collecting and keeping. And so that will definitely be part of any improvements that we make. We'll be ensuring that security is part of it as well. Ease of access and ease of doing business is one thing, but also, like I mentioned, fraud, actually, and making sure we're able to detect and prosecute that if it does come about.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And if there is no one else to speak to us on this, all right, then I'm going to close this informational hearing on DMV service transformation. Okay. All right. And now we're going to, open an informational hearing on ports and marine freight in the state of Oregon. And our first witness is Dave Harlan, if you'd like to come on up. And welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Vice Chair Gorsuch, committee members. For the record, I'm Dave Harlan. I'm the Ports Program Manager for Business Oregon. And I'm here to talk a little bit about the economic impact of ports. You'll hear from several port directors following me. Provided a couple of things to you prior to the meeting. I've got a couple more handouts for you. We conducted a economic impact analysis of the ports that was finished about this time last year. The drive to do that was trying to provide numbers for federal advocacy for core O&M dollars and to provide numbers for the ports to go after grant funds. So you should have a couple of things in front of you. There's a summary of the total impact of the ports. The analysis looks at the combined impact to the ports and the individual impact of each port. And obviously, we have quite a range of port operations and sizes in this state, but I think the key finding, pretty obvious for those of us who work in economic development, is that the ports are really economic drivers, not only for their communities, but for their regions and the state. Mm-hmm. State is relatively dependent on foreign trade. And the ports, it seems, you know, when you combine all of the numbers, it's been in the freight transportation plan and in other plans, roughly 1 in 6 jobs in Oregon can be tied back to freight and port activity. And I think one important thing to note there is we think of the ports, but there are a whole lot of proprietary docks, private facilities that are tied to the marine navigation system, and they provide a substantial number of jobs. An example would be the Teevan Marine Terminal in Rainier. It's tied to the the short line rail system in the state. They had, a Connect Oregon application, and in that they cited that they had 107 Oregon and Northwest firms that shipped through that private terminal. So lots of activity tied to freight and marine transportation in the state. But it's also important to note that the ports are involved in recreation, all sorts of different activities. So there is this, I think there's a one-sheet summary of the economic impacts of the ports, the combined impact. I'm hoping I can find it here momentarily. And that should be in front of you. Roughly 111,000 jobs, $13.2 billion in sales, $5.2 billion, these are annual numbers, in labor income, $596 million in state and local taxes generated by port activity and the companies that are tied to the marine navigation system. So, you know, one of the dilemmas recently has been the decline in federal funding for maintaining coastal harbors and the navigation channel and the Columbia itself. We did get it deepened. The dollars have been relatively inadequate for maintaining it. And when you do deepen a channel, there is a period where, you know, it takes a while for it to sort of, you know, settle in the angle of repose, that sort of thing. So dollars have been a bit scarce. This is a 30-year problem. And that was one of the reasons we undertook this development of this document. It has been successfully used by the Portland District, who are advocates within the core appropriation process. So we have done relatively well with that. But, you know, the channels have not been well maintained. The jetties are in poor condition up and down the coast. There's a major project getting started on the Columbia River jetties now. It'll take a lot of federal appropriations to get that done. But one study concluded that should the North Jetty blow out, the channel would go to 20 feet within 30 days. So lots of work would go away if that wasn't maintained. So, you know, this sort of came to a head in 2013. We had a number of Oregon ports get zeroed out in the federal O&M budget, and the state stepped in and developed a memorandum of agreement with the Corps of Engineers with the Portland District. We're one of two in the nation that have that. The legislature provided $3 million in funding to go with dollars that we already had, and we used that to fill in the gaps and to pay the Corps to do dredging of federal projects at the Oregon coast. One of the handouts I provided looks at Bandon at the mouth of the Coquille River, and for $400,000 worth of annual dredging, and that was sort of an average number, you have 54 local firms tied, you know, motels and others who are tied to that project. Ocean access is important for the local economy. I believe it was 444 jobs, $27 million in economic benefit. So, you know, that's one of the challenges of the work that I do, is that, you know, digging a hole under the water has a sizable economic impact, but there's not much to look at. So, you know, the MOA has served its purpose. We still have a couple million dollars left because the Corps has worked very diligently at using federal funds first. There is what they call the Harbor Maintenance Trust Fund, that roughly $1.5 billion are collected from fees on cargo every year, and historically only half of that has been used. That's typically where we look for O&M dollars. I'm involved with several organizations who are working to fix that. We got language into the Water Resource Development Act, the reauthorization last year, and that helped. But there are still some barriers to getting the full amount out there and doing work. I met with one of those barriers at OMB earlier this year. And so we're hoping that the MOA, we view the MOA as a bridge to the ultimate fix of the Harbor Maintenance Trust Fund. But it is, you know, for now we have dollars available to do this work. You know, as it takes a couple more years to straighten this out, we may need to come back and ask for additional dollars. So I'll respect your time. You've got lots of other speakers to hear from. I'll take any questions anybody has for me.
Thank you. Any questions? All right. Very good. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
All righty. Next, we have Sebastian, is it Deggins? And Kenny Greenwood and Patrick Trapp.
Kevin, I'm sorry.
I said Kenny.
That's my answer.
Sorry about that.
Most anything.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, in any order you'd like, welcome to the committee.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. My name is Kevin Greenwood. I'm the general manager at the Port of Newport. And I am going to have to leave relatively quickly, so I apologize for taking off early. Just wanted to briefly summarize some of the transportation projects that we're working with at the Port of Newport. Probably the biggest project now that the international terminal is completed is the need for an export facility. We have been working and talking to Teven and others about having a laydown facility in close proximity to the terminal with the new US 20 that's been just about to be completed. And our terminal, there's basically a missing point for a product to be dealt with before being placed on ships and vessels. We're also looking at increased interest in mid Willamette Valley ag producers, trying to see the opportunities for nearshore barging to either Tacoma or Oakland. And so the bottom line is that there's a huge interest in this, and we're looking at financing just under $7 million to bring that facility to fruition. The cost-benefit analysis on that project shows a huge savings, as you all note, barging compared to trucking, especially if we may be going to the Seattle area or San Francisco. Those issues may be even more apparent. Another transportation issue, which may not be thought of very often, is our commercial fishing docks. The Port of Newport is the largest commercial fishing fleet in Oregon. We have 250 commercial fishing vessels that generate $100 million to the fishermen between Alaska, Washington, and Oregon. The maintenance of those docks and marine infrastructure continues to be a challenge. We're doing what we can, but that's something that really is critical to making sure that those vessels continue to be productive here in Oregon. One of our 35 tenants is Rogue Brewery, Oregon Brewing Company, and they're looking for another wave of expansion, including the addition of an acre-large warehouse. But we're going to be pursuing a transportation growth management planning grant to take a look at some of the transportation impacts for that type of development. I think that's a wonderful program as well. One thing that I also want to thank this committee and the entire body for is the continued unanimous support for the air facility, Coast Guard Air Facility in Newport. And we also support, of course, the House Joint Memorial 20, which will be heard tomorrow, and we really appreciate the unanimous support on that. The other issue that I'll leave you with as far as our projects is the NOAA Marine Operations Center for the Pacific. We're finding that the anticipated dredging from that was predicted in 2010, which was 5 to 10 years, is actually looking to be more along the lines of every other year. And the cash reserves that that the port holds on to do that dredging is going to be an area, not soon, but in year 10 of our 20-year lease, we're in the fourth year of that lease, you know, that's going to be a major issue for the port, and we want to provide as great a level of service to NOAA as we possibly can. So I think those are some of the main the issues that we have in Newport. We have over 2,000 jobs generated from our facilities that are noted in Dave's report, with an annual gross domestic output of over $300 million to the state's economy. And we just appreciate everything that your committee will do to push forward a robust transportation packet. And if we can be of any help in carrying that forward, we would love to do that.
Great. Thank you, sir. Any questions?
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.
Yes. All right. Yes, sir.
Good afternoon. My name is Sebastian Deegans, and I get the port presentation. So while that's coming up, my Sebastian Deegans, I'm General Manager of Business Development at the Port of Portland, and my address there is 7200 Northeast Airport Way. Great. Thank you very much. So I was asked to give a little summary of current status at the port, and I think, as you know, we're a revenue-driven organization. Our total revenue is about $240 million, of which the majority, $200 million, comes from the airport activity. Fundamentally, we are driven by our business revenues, about 96%. And I'm happy to say business has been pretty good fundamentally. We've got four different terminals, marine terminals in the region, and we're really blessed with a very strong transportation network made up of both railroads, highways, and roads. And this has led to a development of a very diverse business portfolio, which has been helpful to the port in both lean times in 2009, for instance, when other ports were having difficulty to the north of us and such. So we're a very, this is the Columbia River as a whole, but our portfolio in the Portland Harbor is really very representative of this. Last year was our was a great year. It was one of our top 5 years in our over 100-year history in terms of total tonnage, 12.9 million tons. And that came on the basis of a lot of investment that's happened over time. Channel deepening, Dave Harlan alluded to it for very briefly. That has been a real driver of development and port activity along the Columbia Willamette River since it was completed in 2010. And so we've seen at our facilities quarter billion dollars worth of investment in the last few years in the Portland Harbor, double that on the Columbia River, double that again, and with the planned investments that have been announced on the Columbia River as a whole, anywhere over the next years, doubling and tripling, as is identified here. So that's been a real boon to the region. At the port facilities, at the Port of Portland, we've seen investment specifically in the grain elevator, Columbia Export Elevator, that has added 20% to 30% capacity. Portland Bulk Terminals, that is in the process of doubling its capacity. An auto warehousing company, which added a new processing center 2 years ago with the help of Connect Oregon funds, and immediately filled that with Ford exports to China. And that's been a big growth area for us. In fact, we've turned into really the premier auto port of the Northwest. Between in the Portland Harbor, the facilities are shown here. We handle over 500,000 vehicles, domestic, international, import, and more recently, export. The Ford volumes last year grew to just under 50,000, and we've heard from Ford they're going to double again in this coming year as they move from approximately 12 dealerships in China to 60 dealerships. So we'll be seeing this grow. So with all that good news, unfortunately, of course, we have challenges as well. And the single biggest challenge is on the container side. I think a lot has been reported. You're very familiar with it. It's ironic. It's only about 14% of our business, but I think I could be the most successful car salesman at the port and it really wouldn't affect most Oregonians, not the way the container business does. And this is the one that touches most people. There's over 6,000 shippers that move cargo through Terminal 6, and all from this region. And 88%, I think, of the businesses that use Terminal 6 are small businesses that are in all of our jurisdictions. So the loss of service, has come in a quick series of blows this year. Hamburg sued, left in December. Hanjin left in March, and Hapag-Lloyd in April. And that came after really two and a half years of ongoing labor management disputes, as well as a West Coast labor shutdown. And there's significant ramifications for us here. We've identified a few here, the impacts to shippers and producers. I'm sure you've heard from your constituents about this. The lost wages, I think we calculate about 817 direct jobs associated with that. Hanjin used to have a $250,000 payroll every weekend, and they just took that north starting in March. In addition, there's about 100,000 boxes that just went onto the I-5 corridor by rail, by truck, leading to a series of congestion and also just difficulty in accessing markets. I think from my perspective, I've been at the port 30 years, it's really difficult to see this erosion of benefits that have taken a long time for us to build up. So we all know it's really been two overlapping labor issues that have brought us here. An ongoing labor dispute, which unfortunately is not yet resolved, and complicated by coastwide contract negotiations, which I think the latest on that is that the contract was ratified here on May 22nd, and so the stage is set at least for resolution of the issues here as well. And if not immediate resolution, at least arbitration mechanisms in place that will help work continue at Terminal 6. We've done a number of things over the last 2 years to try to retain the service. It's been with the help of Governor Kitzhaber, and a number of the different programs are identified here. It's been a huge financial burden, and it probably resulted in keeping Hanjin here for a little while longer. But frankly, I think things were so intolerable that they had no choice but to leave. Where are we today? We're striving to keep the terminal open to serve what customer remains. Brought in an outside company, Harbor Industrial, to do crane mechanical work. And they're working in earnest to make sure that we're ready when service requires to have all the cranes at tip-top performance. Our commission adopted a carrier incentive program in January, which is still in place. And that incentive program was designed to either help retain business or be used as a opportunity to bring new business in. It's a $4 million program. It's essentially the entire rent from our terminal operator. And, of course, we're working with the governor's team on interim freight solutions as the strategic investment fund program moves underway. Finally, of course, we need to market the terminal, but it's going to be very difficult unless we first have found ways to reduce the terminal issues and return to a productive labor force in Portland. So those are the efforts that are going on now. We've done a trans-Pacific analysis of all the services that are out there. There's approximately 38 trans-Pacific services, i.e., for services like Hanjin. 20 of them have vessels that are too large to call the Columbia River. but 18 could. And we're pretty certain that at least three or four of those would be a good fit in terms of serving the markets, having the sales force and personnel here, having the equipment available. And we've done a lot of work with the shipper community to try to develop cargo commitments that we can take to the carriers in the coming months to get service back. We have one carrier still, it's Westwood. They call once a month. They had suspended their calling Portland and called Tacoma for a period of time during this until the labor contract was renewed. They're looking at resuming in the July-August timeframe. So we hope to be open for business at a very limited level with them here shortly. And I think that really concludes my remarks. I know I've covered a lot very quickly, so I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yes, Representative Blackman.
So I apologize. I probably have read or followed this, but still not a little confused over the labor issue. So I read where there was a West Coast settlement.
Correct.
So the West Coast settlement applies also to Portland.
Does
that resolve whatever the total labor disputes, or are there still individual labor disputes within Portland versus the West Coast?
Unfortunately, that does not resolve the ongoing labor dispute here.
Okay.
What it does do is put back in place arbitration mechanisms and grievance mechanisms that were put on hold since July of last year. So those and essentially, of a terminal, if there's no mechanism to bring labor back,
to table.
Leads to walkouts.
So now you go through a process that could have gone through before, but they were suspended. But now you'll go through the arbitration process and then try to reach a conclusion.
Correct.
Thank you.
Also, in terms of that, the port's kind of in a difficult spot, because it's really ILWU and the terminal operator that are at odds. How much can the port take an active role in that in terms of the ongoing, which I understand was a problem before the labor, the long West Coast strike?
Well, the port as the landlord has certain rights per contract, and the terminal operator as a tenant has certain responsibilities as well. So we are moving aggressively in those areas that we have. So, for instance, I mentioned crane maintenance. Crane maintenance has been an issue of contention for several years. It's been alleged the cranes weren't properly maintained and therefore not available, whereas, again, in other people, there were other points of view on that. Governor Kitzhaber had asked the port to pursue a study of the cranes, an independent study, and we are implementing all those recommendations. So that's something that we can do. We've worked, I think, also aggressively with the governor's office to try to initiate some of the mediation meetings that need to proceed. So I think in areas where we are able, we're actively pursuing forums. Similarly, with the shippers, we've convened several meetings with shippers, both and the terminal operator, to bring them together as well. So all parties will be needed to get us out of the mess that we're in.
Well, and as I'm sure you know, both leadership in the legislature and also a number of us in the House have been very concerned about this. And as you were saying, especially the impact across Oregon, this is something that reaches into Southeast Oregon, Northeast Oregon, and the cost when you go to shipping it to Seattle, Tacoma, which is also our competition, goes up substantially. So anything that we can do to help with this, I'm sure the legislature would be very interested in helping move this process forward.
No, we appreciate that, and I think the letter that was sent earlier by the legislature that you were involved in, thank you for that. I think that all the political pressure is important to helping the parties get together.
Great. So. Thank you, sir. Any other questions? All right. Representative Heck.
So you talked a little bit about the issues with the Hanjin leaving and all of that. So are you just now kind of wrapping your head around what you're thinking you might do? Can you at all elaborate on what you are going to do? I mean, do you have plans to get somebody else in there? Do you...
There actually are good prospects. The Westwood service that currently calls, they've been looking at opportunities to expand and to grow. We have other there. We do need to work with ICTSI, the terminal operator, on that. But we have years of relationships and other carriers who have been here in the past. So I think we've identified by looking at the profile of both where our trading partners, where Oregon's goods are going, and such, which existing lines would be beneficial for us there. So Hyundai has a service that we've targeted as perhaps a short-term interested party, as well as some other carriers. We have some. For many carriers, though, the decision to change ports or to add a port is a decision they need a lot of time in advance to put onto their schedule. So I cannot suggest that there's a short-term fix for that. We're probably looking at a year or more for real Trans-Pacific service, unless we're very, very lucky.
Can I follow up?
Yes.
Are you concerned at all about the potential long-term issues that may hang over our heads, so to speak, with that, given the fact that we didn't take care of the problem and it ended the way that it did, and the effects that it had on the port and our state? And if so, what are we doing on a PR side, kind of, or what are your plans to take care of that? Because in my mind, that's a huge issue, because we really let that go on for a long time, and it's sad that it happened. And what are your plans to deal with that?
Well, I think I've talked a lot to agricultural groups in the state, and have said that in overall the container industry, West Coast wide, has been a really bad partner for the ag industry, because it's just a lot of the problems that have been reported have not just occurred in Portland, have occurred on the West Coast in general. And it's a concern to us in the industry that the West Coast has lost market share to other parts of the country, as people have looked for more reliable outlets. I think this isn't something we can attack with PR. We've really damaged our reputation, and we're going to have to work really hard to regain it through reliable service. That's fundamentally where we're going to have to work through. And I think the reliability will start in the next months, and we will need to market together with the ILWU and the terminal operator. That's a fundamental piece of it. I've been told by Hanjin that I could tell them anything I wanted, but until I was sitting in front of them, like I'm sitting in front of you, Representative Hack, today, with ILWU president on one side and a terminal operator on the other, they would not, that would not, we would not be believable. So I think reliability will take us there, but it's going to be a long time in us earning that.
Yes.
I understand what you're saying, but I have to tell you that concerns me, though. If you think you can only get there by reliability, but then you say you're going to market, you've got to go out. The only way you're going to build trust is if you're also talking about what you're doing. The public and the people of Oregon and those that we're trying to attract to come in have to know, and they've got to understand what is your plan. And so, again, I want to know, how are you going to do that? So how are you going to build trust and reliability, and not just, I want to know, this is a huge issue. This is a huge economic driver for our state, and when you talk about the ag side and industry, I want to know, I guess, what is your plan, though? And if it isn't PR, but you're going to market, how do you not see those two things working hand in hand? You can't build trust without talking about it. And,
sure.
And how do you plan to do that if that's not,
sure,
if you
no.
don't see that as important?
No, I think I understand your question. There were clearly, we are talking a lot about this. This is the first week where I probably, since February or March, that I haven't been in front of at least 100 people during the week, to shippers, to people, to grain growers in Pendleton. There's a lot to what you say. The community needs to know that we're engaged in addressing the situation, so that they make decisions as they are solving their very real logistic problems, that they're making decisions in a way that support our ability to come back. I'll give you one example. I talked with a firm that has been importing equipment for the brewing industry. They're doing great. They're Portland based right now. They need to expand, and they're facing a dilemma. Do they expand now near, or do they move to Seattle, near to where their equipment comes in, or do they trust that we will, as a community, solve the issues here? And fortunately, because they've been involved in a number of our shipper meetings and they understand that we're actively engaged, they've decided to expand within the Portland metro area and stay local and give it some more time. That kind of trust is really important. I think that comes through the communication that you're talking about. On the carrier side, we have the same kind of communication that we need to talk to them. Fundamentally, we have a great story to tell as a region about the market size, the growth of the import and the export commodities from this area. That's very attractive to carriers. We still have an operating issue that we need to convince them of, and that will be convinced through demonstration. But there's a lot of communication that's going on there too with the carrier community. We and that's been the basis of sort of the analytical work on the market.
How about on the international side?
In terms of one of the marketing employees for me, he was just in Asia. He had meetings with four different carriers while he was there. So we're continuing the communication, but they are all, this is a difficult time even for them because they're, as I said before, they've all been hurt by the West Coast issues. All of the carriers are struggling with working themselves out of the backlog that they have in all ports, Portland contributed to that, but it's been difficult to get their attention at this point in time. I think that time is coming, though, where we'll have an opportunity to get more attention with the carriers. We're planning, some of the decisions are made by in the North American realm, and those will be carriers that we visit here. We've got a trip with our terminal operator planned in July to visit one of the carriers that I mentioned here in the United States. So there's work going on in that regard.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Trapp.
Chair Gorsuch, committee members, I'm Patrick Trapp. I'm the executive director for the Port of St. Helens in Columbia City. Thank you all for taking time today to hear about both the opportunities and challenges associated with the ports trying to reach their full potential here as an economic driver. It's always difficult following the Port of Portland with our big brother here, as well as Sebastian personally, because he is so complete and does such a great job. But let me paint a little picture for where we are in St. Helens, much smaller port. We have 13 employees, although we have a rather large expanse of the Columbia River, 53 miles along the Columbia River system. And spread out quite a much. But as I reflect on the change of the economy, especially as it pertains to Columbia County, I know I'm preaching to the choir by saying that there many are still dealing with very difficult times. In Columbia County alone, we just recently, after several attempts, passed a levy to keep our jails open. The county offices are still on furlough days to balance the expenses as well as to keep services going. So there are many that are struggling in our rural area just outside the metropolitan lines here. On the other hand, Port of St. Helens has been doing quite well. Small, but still making good headway. We had vacant buildings we were able to take advantage of. We had land that we could allow people to expand and or provide development on. And, of course, we had a superior workforce that was obviously looking for opportunities for employment. It was a but don't get me wrong, we're not rolling in the dough. It's not all roses, but we are doing our best to retain primarily and attract those businesses that are looking for traded sector jobs and the opportunities to move to an area close to a metropolitan area but still have much of the quality of life that people are looking to get away and out of the urban environment. But there are still challenges. I'm going to take a little bit of your time, but not all of it, to talk about some of the opportunities and those respective challenges. You know, the obvious ones that we're dealing with, dredging everywhere remains an issue. For our little area, we have a small marina. We operate out of Scappoose Bay. It took 3 years to get our permit to dredge that little marina after it hasn't been dredged for over 25 years. The first estimate has come in from one of our bidders is just over $1.8 million to dredge that little area and so we can still have access to the Columbia River system. Land use challenges are still daunting, and we look at the time sink it takes not only to go through a zoning requirement, but then any conditional or other permitting issues which seem to add duplicity along the way. We talk about permitting on the and work on the river itself. Now we talk about the Army Corps of Engineers and the long, long process it takes to bring everyone together to look at all of those issues associated with the maritime world. In a couple of our permitting processes, we're 2+ years, and we anticipate many months to go on some of those. But it's not all gloom and doom, and I don't want to paint that picture. We have tried to do our best along those lines. We have a prospective tenant now that Northwest Innovation Works that looks to bring a methanol production plant to Port Westward and to Columbia County. That'll be a $1.8 billion investment and up to 225 full-time permanent positions out there. And put in perspective, the county assesses at $4 billion. So this one project would certainly be a game changer in regard to what we're talking about for providing a tax base and services and ongoing opportunities for our area. We're primarily a landlord-tenant port, but we've tried to do a very conservative fiscal approach in what we're looking at. So we've, over the last 6 years, we've been able to realize a 26% annual growth beginning with our beginning balance over the last 6 years. You know, of course, when you start with little, it's easy to have double digits for the preceding year. So it's still working. But we've been able to leverage our tax increment over that same period of time, which is approximately $1.9 million over a six-year period. And we've combined that with our revenues and our, and what you'll hear again, the port's ability to really take advantage of grants, loans, and leverage those expertise into completing over $31 million of capital improvements in the port area. So a huge success. I know very little organizations, especially on the public side, that gets that much bang for the buck along those lines. But as a special district, I do think we're uniquely placed to take advantage of both state and federal opportunities for grants. You heard Dave talk a little bit about the economic analysis to try to give us some of that foundation as we look at it regionally and statewide. But at times, it's still a challenge as we try to modernize our key maritime assets. Because there are fears by some that ports and the nature of our business and what we do, that we ship products, we move products, we store products, and some of those might, could, or would be considered controversial, and it creates fear. and that fear is a difficult thing to get over. I mentioned vacant buildings. We spent the last 2 years recapitalizing 3 buildings for a total of roughly 75,000 square feet of space. We've added 2 new buildings for roughly 65,000 additional square feet of space. All of that is currently occupied. We now have ORPET, which is the plastic bottle recycling plant, where every single water bottle in the state that's recycled through OBRC comes to the Port of St. Helens and is flaked from there. And that's about 2/3 of their capacity, and they're looking for more business. So they reached over to Washington to try to take some of their bottles. Unfortunately, they don't have the same system as we do, so they're not as clean and requires a much greater process of cleaning them and filtering them and getting them ready for actually redistributing as a recycled product. Truth be told, if I had 4 additional 20,000, 30,000 square foot buildings in this last year, I could have rented them 2 times over. People aren't looking to buy, to look to build yet in Columbia County, but they want established buildings, and they're looking for places to move over, especially as we see some of the larger companies in the urban area get bigger. And so these small to medium-sized manufacturers and processors are looking for their own place where they know they have an opportunity to grow, and they know they have the opportunity to set down roots and be there for a while. Great opportunity to be our location, close to Portland. One of our niches is we do have a lot of land. Roughly have about a total of 2,600 acres for the Port of St. Helens, spread out over that expansive area, but unfortunately not all of it is appropriately zoned, and we're working towards that, which leads me to a challenge. But like many, if not most, of the ports, we have recently completed, or long since completed, in our case, our strategic business plan. That strategic business plan established and looked at our focus and what we're going to do for the next 5, 10, 15 years out. It was went through public input, in fact, 10 public meetings for our case. We've had long review established against this criteria that the state worked on, a peer review for other ports. It went from then the Port Commission, Business Oregon review, and then the Port Commission approval of an IGA contract with the state on how we're going to implement those things. But we were in trying to move forward with that strategic business plan. I have to admit, little did we realize, maybe my naivete, that my perception is how uncomfortable and how resistant both at local level and sometimes the state level is in regard to long-term strategic planning. If it's not in front of you, if you can't see exactly what's going to go there, it's very difficult and it's been near impossible for someone to make that leap to say, okay, what's it going to take to prepare that site so that we can open up all or most of the options that you're looking towards? That's been an unbelievable challenge. And I've talked with many elected officials, the city, county, and otherwise, that take great pride in dealing, being reactive. Put something in front of me, I will look at it, and I will give you an answer. But short of that, it's going to take a lot longer and to see what we need to do. We need to be, we have to be, forward-thinking. We need to continue to look 10 and 15 years out in the future. As I mentioned before, there's a lot of people uncomfortable with doing that. It's understandable given the demand, increased regulatory demands and requirements, the competing demands of state and federal permitting issues, at times what appears to be a paralysis collecting every single bit of information that can be checked, cross-checked, and then verified by third and fourth party, and then ultimately the lawsuit that's going to recur no matter what the decision's made. But real efforts have been made, I believe, at least on the state level, at least to make some attempts. DEQ is trying to work a streamlining issue. The Regional Solutions Teams is a great step to try to combine these efforts. It's just not enough when we talk about the big projects, long-term look that many of these ports are trying to accomplish. We need a frequent champion, and we're hoping this committee can be that champion as we continue to look at that. I'm not suggesting we do away with our checks and balances. They're absolutely important. But we have to find that common thread that all of these agencies are willing to take that they can start working with rather than start from scratch every time we do work with them. And then now, again, consider dealing in the maritime transportation side of the house, namely for us, Beaver Dock at Port Westward. Just capitalizing on the 70-year-plus structure, we were able to highlight the potential of a modern deep water terminal, the potential for that on the Columbia River. one of the last, I think, capable spots, 70, up to 70 feet, self-scouring. We don't need dredging there. The Army, because of ammunition locations for the Army, they made some good decisions in making sure they didn't have to do much work other than put in the dock and keep cargo moving from there. In fact, if we look at our own ORS 777.065, it highlights the need for, quote, development of port facilities at certain ports as a state economic goal. It goes on to say the development of deepwater port facilities at Astoria, Coos Bay, Newport, Portland, and St. Helens is declared to be a state economic goal of high priority. All agencies of the state of Oregon are directed to assist in promptly achieving the creation of such facilities by processing applications for necessary permits in an expeditious manner and by assisting the ports involved with available financial assistance or services when necessary. Unquote. Love it. As a port director, love it. I can't say that I have to say this should be the foundation we're both using to jumpstart economic development, using the port's existing infrastructure and experience to create opportunities that focus on capitalizing all of the transportation options, whether that be air, rail, road, highway, and especially the international gateway and the maritime interstate, M84, we all know is the Columbia River system. We need to ask that we use the ports, we leverage the ports. We are all focused and driven to see economic development within our areas of responsibility. We, too, are community members. We're residents. We, too, expect and demand that any new development that comes to our areas achieve and maintain the high standards set by Oregon. These are our highest priorities, and I know that they're the highest priorities for the state, too. So thank you, and I'll be happy to entertain any questions.
Any brief questions? Yes.
This is very short, and you don't even have to answer it right now, but I'd love to hear from you about this. You talked about the regional solutions team, and the state has put a lot of money toward those teams trying to get the agencies to coordinate so that the permitting processes and the land use processes or the transportation permits or whatever you're working on, you know, that there's, you know, some kind of combined system. So as you point out, that you don't have to start over every time you deal with a different agency. So if you've got a list of things that they still need to improve on, we'd sure love to see it.
Sure. And my issue is not that I think it's a great start, and they are doing that mm-hmm. for, I would say, the 80% of things which are consistently addressed. Mm-hmm. But when you get that large project that is considered any bit controversial, personal opinion is stovepipes go back up.
Okay.
You know, got to start protecting what we need to do and who we're answering to and how it's being done.
Okay.
I don't fault the regional solutions team. You know, together they're trying to collaboratively work, but everyone reports to someone. So.
All right. Well, thank you both
thank
very
you.
Much.
Mm-hmm.
And now, Anne Marie Lundberg, Bud Shoemake. And Michael, is it Sandin? No?
He's not going to be with us. Mr. Okay. Chairman, we go to...
How about David Cook, then? Is it Koch or Cook? Koch. Sorry about that. Unfortunately, as frequently happens when we're getting a lot of good information, time begins to run a little short. So, but we still have almost 25 minutes, so if we could kind of... moving along a tad bit. I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but please go ahead at whatever.
Well, I usually talk too fast.
Oh, perfect.
And
all
I'm
right.
usually trying to slow myself down, but in this case, I'll change. My name is Anne Marie Lundberg. First, let me start by saying, Vice Chair Gorsuch and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to participate in this discussion, very important discussion on challenges and opportunities for Oregon ports. My name is Anne Marie Lundberg, and I am here representing Gary Neal and the Port of Morro in Boardman, Oregon. Port of Morro is the largest upriver port. You've heard from two other ports about the importance of their economic impact in their communities. And for those of you who don't know the town of Boardman, it's about 3,000 people. The port owns more than 12,000 acres, of which 2,500 acres are currently zoned for industrial development, shovel-ready 2,500 acres adjacent to the Columbia River. Our business portfolio includes food processing industries, grain exports, various biofuel manufacturers, power generation, and most recently data farms, as is happening in a lot of the eastern part of the state. The port did an economic impact analysis in June of 2013, and that states that port-related businesses accounted for more than $1.6 billion in economic output in 2011. And while that number in and of itself is impressive for a community of 3,000 people, even more impressive to me is that that's up from about $850 million in 2006. So Port of Morro in Boardman is the economic driver in that region. There's no doubt, and if you've had the joy of reading through the planning documents, as I have, you'll see that everybody states that in that part. They understand and appreciate the importance of the Port of Morro. And so in talking to you about some of the opportunities, clearly, oftentimes we like to build on our strengths, and that's where the Port of Morro continues to see opportunities. Food processing is strong in that area. Multiple food and agricultural process products are processed currently in and around the port complex. We mentioned, some of the other speakers mentioned competition, and I'll talk about competition. Regionally, food processing, we face a lot of competition in the state of Oregon from the Columbia River Basin, Yakima Valley, and around the Tri-Cities area. They are developing refrigerated storage and processing capacities as quickly as we are in Boardman, and so there's intense competition from across the river. Energy, and we know that this is a flashpoint, and the Port of Morro certainly has been involved in that particular controversy, but I'd like to point out that we are a cluster of energy generating companies, and it's not just coal we're talking about. We have an ethanol facility located, we actually have two ethanol facilities, and we are piping currently some ethanol to a barge facility located on port property as well. So we are moving, helping facilitate the movement of ethanol to the Portland metro area by barge. And so, and in addition to that, we have a tire manufacturer or a tire recycler who takes old tires and takes out the hydrocarbons and develops additional fuel sources from that. We have a demonstration project that is converting biofuels from cellulosic product. And so there's a lot of activity for both old-style fossil fuels as well as some of the new and more innovative energy sources. So I would ask that you look at it as a whole and not just the one. We've talked a lot, the Port of Portland talked a lot about international exports, and we certainly share that pain upriver. And I'd like to just tell a personal anecdote when we talk about the importance to the whole state of viable container service. I was on vacation in Korea last year around this time, and I took a ferry from Busan to Fukuoka, Japan. And I got really excited because RDO Calbee is one of the tenants at Port of Portland, and they make potato-based snack products that are very popular in Asia. And on this ferry, I got to buy some product that was made at Port of Morro by RDO Calbee. There's these little potato sticks. So that just gives you some real-life view of the importance and the direct connection that Port of Morro and Boardman, Oregon has to the international marketplace. So I'll hurry up. Now we get to the challenges here. So I'm going to echo some of the things that other people have said. Preserving port capacity and permitting are all challenges. So in Coyote Island Terminal submitted an application for a removal fill permit needed to construct a barge dock at the Port of Morro. 2.5 years later, and after 8 deadline extensions, DSL denied the permit. Port of Morro is contesting the permit denial, and a tentative hearing date has been set for February 2016, 4 years later. So I think this just highlights the need for a more expeditious process, and as was stated earlier, certainly particularly when it's controversial, you know, millions of dollars are wasted just in the waiting around for everything to come out. And then we also talked, Patrick Trapp mentioned, that we feel the need that we want to preserve capacity for maritime commerce in Oregon's upriver region. 98% of the shoreline is set aside for other uses other than port, in particular habitat and recreation, including fishing. There are very few locations upriver that are suitable for maritime commerce. And so we just would like to say that when there's an opportunity to increase capacity, it's not going to take a lot, you know, even it's just not going to impinge a lot, but we need to protect those resources, those transportation resources, and make sure that we can expand those resources as the economy demands it. I won't. The Port of Portland so well went over the international barging situation, and certainly the upriver barges. And there's a huge pent-up demand upriver for the for additional container service by barge downriver. And I want to talk a little bit about public investment. The Port of Morrow has been very successful in every Connect Oregon app round to date, and that public investment, and I can't remember the numbers exactly, 30, 40 million, something like that, has leveraged hundreds of millions of dollars in private investment in that community. It is a terrific cost benefit story. And so we want to make sure and want to emphasize that it is very critical to continue to find sources for public infrastructure investment so that we leverage those, particularly when we talk about the regional competition, but also when we talk about, and I did attach a letter that Gary provided from the governor of the state of Florida, and it just shows, as somebody else previously said, there are other port areas in this country that are looking to get pick up West Coast business, and they are investing in their states, and they're aggressively marketing it. And so we're a small state. We need to be on top of it. We need to make sure we're making those investments so we stay relevant. And again, finally, uncertain permitting and land and investment landscape. I think we just want to make sure one of the dangers we see is if we start getting product-specific in our permitting, we can easily come down the road where all of a sudden public opinion is driving away fair, legally transported products. And so, you know, we can't necessarily pick and choose through the permitting process. We have to make sure that what is legal to transport is transported. And that doesn't just go for coal, but goes for all types of commodities. So I would just encourage folks to keep that in mind as we're making decisions and make sure that the permitting landscape is fair and even and efficient and effective. So with that, I will thank you all very much for your time and attention regarding this important issue, and the Port of Morrow looks forward to working with you to progress the interests of the state of Oregon. Thank you very much.
Go ahead. Whoever's next.
Thank you.
And then we'll circle back if people have questions.
Vice Chair Gorsuch, members of the committee, my name is David Kosh. I'm the Chief Executive Officer for the Port of Coos Bay, and I appreciate the invitation to come back and talk to you a little bit about the Port of Coos Bay. Port of Coos Bay is located on the southern Oregon coast. We are the largest, Coos Bay North Bend are the largest population center on the Oregon coast. Having said that, the combined population of those two cities is 26,000, and the entire county is around 66,000, which is the same population it had in 1980. It has actually come back up to that number after the decline in the 80s related to the downturn in the timber industry. And really, the tale of the Port of Coos Bay is one of a 30-year attempt to recover from that nosedive that occurred through the 80s and the 90s, where we saw on the industrial side the Port of Coos Bay fall from 14 active deep draft terminals down to 2 deep draft terminals in 2009. We're back up to 4. Two of them limping along on what's left of the log export market to China at the moment, the other two exporting wood chips. We are still very heavily timber dependent. With the decline in wood products through the port, we also saw a decline in wood products on our rail line, which was constructed in the early 1900s, which resulted in the shutdown of that railroad in 2007. We have also seen declines on the marina side, the commercial fishing side, recreational tourism during that same period of time that resulted in the port taking over a boatyard and an RV park and an ice plant. We actually own and operate a lot of facilities that the private sector failed to maintain during that 30-year economic depression, and we are working very hard to make investments in that infrastructure as a public agency to bring it back up. I will say in terms of where we stand today, we are not the largest commercial fishing fleet, but we're one of them. Newport has, of course, that distinction. We did 33 million pounds of fish and shellfish through our Charleston facilities, though, in 2013. That represented 450 jobs at the peak of the wholesale fish processing season in the Charleston area. We also have another 38 jobs that are actively in the boatyard that the port now owns, and we lease space out to commercial tenants that do vessel repair, fabrication, gear changes, and whatnot. We are
undertaking this year a reinvestment in the travel lift that we have. There's a 60-ton travel lift there that's operated by the private boatyard or a private tenant there. The port is getting ready through a partnership with the state and the Infrastructure Finance Authority to borrow $600,000 in order to upgrade that to 110-ton travel lift. Nowhere near the 600-ton travel lift you hear about at the Port of Toledo, but for us, it allows us to capture roughly 85% of the fleet within our region and provide haul-out services for vessel repair. The rail line, as I mentioned, was shut down in 2007, acquired by the port in the 2009 and 2010 period with two different segments. We reopened the line in 2011, a portion of the line in 2011. We reopened the entire line in 2013. And last year, 2014, we saw 7,500 carloads, revenue carloads, transported on that rail line, up from 2,500 in our first full year of operations. To put that into context, those 7,500 carloads kept 25,000 semi-trucks off of narrow coastal highways that would have been deadheaded one way and hauled back the other way. We have, though, 118 bridges and 9 tunnels on that line, a significant amount of infrastructure that saw 20 years of deferred maintenance before it was shut down, and we are still working diligently with state and federal money to reinvest in that. The last thing I want to talk about is the Jordan Cove LNG Export Terminal project, which is the big project down in Coos Bay. I know you had some other folks up here yesterday that maybe represented a different point of view on that project. For us at the port, and really for the business community in that region, the LNG Export Terminal project is essential for the revitalization of maritime economy in Coos Bay. Beyond the $8 billion private investment, beyond the thousands of construction jobs that we'll see over a four-year period, and beyond the 180 permanent jobs that we will see once that facility is operating, the project will also generate $12 million during construction and $23 million during operations to fund local government services, a foundation that's being established to support schools not only in the Coos Bay area but throughout all of Coos County, the Reedsport School District area in Douglas County, and the Port Orford Langless School District in Curry County, as well as community enhancement projects and economic development activities, so that the Jordan Cove project is not a one-off for us. There are also, the Jordan Cove project is critical to the port's efforts to deepen our navigation channel to 45 feet, which I testified before this committee about a couple of months ago. Deepening our channel from 37 feet to 45 feet is critical to bolstering our ability to recruit new shipping opportunities, not just for Coos Bay, but for Oregon. For us, that project represents a lot of things that will position us to be able to reverse that trend that we've seen over the last 30 years and revitalize Coos Bay. Beyond that, I'll stand for questions and reiterate everything you heard about regulatory streamlining, which is incredibly important.
Yes. All right. Thank you, sir.
All right. Good afternoon. I'll try to keep it quick. And Vice Chair Gorsuch and the rest of the committee, I'm Bud Shoemake, and I'm the port manager in Toledo, Oregon. So we're a small coastal port inland from Newport, about 14 river miles. And we were founded in 1910, and we're a tool of the state. So I'll talk a little bit about our boatyard, because that's kind of the biggest project we've ever done. And we got a Connect Oregon grant this last year to expand our boatyard. We had a private operator that closed the boatyard about 5 years ago, and then we came in and we were the first loan the Infrastructure Authority gave, and the governor kicked in some money to help us out on that. But what we've got is an old, tired, floating dry dock that came from Coos Bay. Bought 20 years for $1,500. That might tell you something. But it's one on, one off, and it can only deal with the smaller of our larger boats. Toledo provides most of the boat work for the Newport fleet and a number of boats that come from Alaska and the South Pacific. So we draw boats down there. We have one of our tenants is Yaquina Boat, has another shipyard. They don't do any out of the water work, but they've been with us for 30 years and are really a good tenant. But this project is going to have the largest mobile lift in Oregon, in Washington too, and it will be about 600 tons and capable of pulling boats out of the water, getting them up on land and doing work in an environmentally right way. And you know, the fishermen, they're regulated by the seasons. They have to fish, and so a lot of our work is you know, you pull a boat out of the water and you find a shaft is bad, then that backs everybody up on the schedule and nobody's happy. So, and there is a shortage of boat yards. So I support what Coos Bay is doing, what Astoria is doing, any of our coastal ports. It's important that we support that industry. We are the final phase of our boat yard is a large building, 150 by 110 by 75 feet tall, that's going to be a building you can actually work year-round in, sandblast in the middle of the winter, in a totally environmentally right way. So we're chasing some federal money for that right now, and hopefully that's going to happen. One of the newest additions to us was Fish People Seafood, and you may have seen the lottery commercials on that, but what's important about them, number one, they're a very smart, savvy business, that everything's sustainable and green. And but what really excited me about them is that on the Oregon coast, there's about 10 million pounds of tuna landed, and about 5 of that comes into Newport. And of that 5, virtually none of it is processed in Oregon. It goes out of state, out of country to be processed. So this is a step forward on that. They're doing some pretty innovative things. They're cutting fish with water jets, which is the first time that that's been done. And we're pretty excited about that. Permitting, I can't say enough. About that.
How well, you know, it's working.
What's that?
Of how well it's working.
Yeah.
How few of those you have to have.
And one of the challenges of all the coastal ports here is the 100-year floodplain issues that are coming up with FEMA, you know, because for a number of us, we need upland dredge spoil areas, and now we can't use our dredge spoil areas. So that's going to be a huge issue. We can temporarily store, but then we have to move, so. In the sake of time, if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Any brief questions? Yes, Representative Blackwood.
That last issue you mentioned, so the issue is now because of the new mapping or established mapping, they're all within that zone and they have to be moved out.
Yes, just virtually all of them.
That's what I thought. Thank you.
Representative Pack.
Thank you, Chair. I have more of a comment, I think, than I really do a question. Mm-hmm. Is that
sure.
Okay? I just wanted to, I don't know a whole lot about Toledo, so thank you for sharing. That was good. I grew up in Pendleton, so I know a lot about the Port of Morrow, but I just wanted to say that you guys are doing it right, and you're doing some really great work, and I'm really excited about what's happening in Coos Bay. The deepening of the channel, I think, is just the first step in the work that can be done there, and I think that there is so much potential there for our state that I really hope that we stay committed to what needs to happen there. It just depends on how much the folks in Coos Bay really want, I think. Right. Because really the potential in the sky is the limit in my mind there. And I just really think that we need to stay committed to the work that needs to happen there, because you've got, I mean, the gold mine is there.
Yeah.
And so I just am really thankful that we are seeing that and the work that you're doing.
Thank you. I couldn't agree more.
That's surprising. Well, thank you all very much.
All right.
And I think Representative Pack is absolutely right. And these are very inspiring stories that we're hearing. And we need to do more, because it doesn't all occur in, you know, the North Valley. It needs to occur in a lot of places. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our final panelist today is Mr. Steve Woods, if you would like to come forward. And I don't need to already tell you about it. Yeah, we've kind of ripped you off in terms of time. I apologize for that. But thank you for being here.
Thank you. I'm Captain Steve Woods. I am one of the 62 Oregon State licensed pilots for the Oregon region. There's 15 bar pilots for the Columbia River bar. We have 40 unlimited tonnage pilots for the Columbia River with 5 people in the training process. It takes 3 years to get someone from starting the training up to where they're unlimited. And these trainees are actually captains that have been probably operating as captain on the river for anywhere from 5 to 12 years before they even start our training program or are admitted by the state. We have 2 unlimited tonnage pilots down in Coos Bay. I am licensed unlimited for Coos Bay, Yaquina Bay, and also the Columbia and Willamette River. And currently I'm the president of the Columbia River Pilots. The Oregon State Board of Maritime Pilots was formed in 1846, one of the first legislative things by the Oregon Territory, and it was to assure the safe navigation and handling of the vessels crossing the bar at that time, and that hasn't changed. There's a more emphasis on our part to represent the state and its interests as far as safety is concerned. We're there to make sure that when that vessel moves, it's done at a safe time in a safe manner. And regardless of the economic repercussions of our decisions, that being said, it's in our best interest to make sure that economically everything's moving well, because if everyone else is doing well, then we're doing well. We're very happy to see what's happening down in Coos Bay. I started my first 14 years as a pilot there, and when things had deteriorated and the shipping went away, well, I was given the opportunity to transfer up to the Columbia River, train and work there, but also retain my license for Coos Bay as a backup for when things possibly turned around, if somebody got sick or whatever, and it's worked very well. It'd be nice to see things pick back up at Coos Bay. We were doing close to 400 ships a year there at one time at the height, and we're down to about 48 ships a year there now. Mm-hmm. And it's got capability of doing a lot more. Newport, we had through the 80s or 86 through about 92, we had, I think the last ship was 2002, but we were up to about 3 to 4 log ships a month in and out of there. So that's very doable as well. And in the Columbia River system, we're still doing well. We're sad to lose the containers for hopefully the short period of time. Our meat and potatoes is the grain and the bulk commodities, and that's done pretty well. Last year was a very good year. This year we're down about 20% as far as actual ship numbers or assignments, but that's the nature of our business, is for things to fluctuate from one year to the next. But that's about all I can say. Is there any questions?
Well, one thing, I understand that the Columbia River Bar is one of the most dangerous to cross in, if not the Pacific, or the world, actually.
It has its moments. Yeah. The Pacific Ocean can be calm a good percentage of the time. The difference between the Columbia River Bar and, say, Coos Bay or Yaquina Bay is when you cross the Columbia River Bar, they're exposed in the bar area for almost 3 miles. Mm. But they have lots of room, but it's still, they have a lot of river going out. You have the forces with the ocean, and it can be very nasty for at least 3 miles. So if it's going to be a breaking bar, they're going to take a break somewhere in there. Coos Bay or Yaquina Bay, we have a 400-foot wide at the entrance. Less at Yaquina Bay. If you have the same ocean conditions, which we work just as tough down there as they do up here, we're exposed for about 1,600 feet. Mm. And so if we get hit by something and get knocked sideways, we have no room to recover, but we're exposed a lot less. So it's apples and oranges. As far as getting out there and getting aboard the ships at sea, well, it's... Coastal Oregon isn't the nicest place in the wintertime.
Very true.
Any questions?
So getting out there and getting on board, is that helicopter?
The Columbia River Bar pilots use the helicopter about 70% of the time. Otherwise, they use their pilot boats.
You use the pilot boats.
Coos Bay and Yaquita Bay, we use pilot boats exclusively, but we only have to go out 3 to 5 miles. The bar pilots, they go out sometimes 15 miles.
Oh, okay.
And so there's a difference there. There's, sure. Again, the apples and oranges in the grounds.
You said that you were rated both for the Willamette River and the bar?
No. I take the ships from the Astoria Bridge, or actually Astoria Bridge up to the Portland-Vancouver area.
Okay.
So I'm a river pilot.
And there's
bar
a difference
pilots,
then, right?
Yes, the bar pilots get aboard out at sea, sometimes out to 15 miles, and they bring them in the
Astoria. Astoria?
Yeah. Or vice versa, we bring them down the river. We have about 80 to 90 miles of work. They have about 15 to 18 miles.
Well, and what people, I think, sometimes forget is that the channel is actually not that wide when you're going up to Portland.
It's 600 feet wide.
The river looks huge,
yes.
But it is literally a highway.
The project channel that's maintained is a 600-foot wide channel.
Yeah.
Depending on your draft, you have more room than that.
Right.
But if you're a deep draft vessel and...
That's crazy.
If you're a deep draft vessel and we have a 43-foot channel.
Yeah.
We bring we operate the ships at 43 feet. We have a minimum clearance that we try to maintain at 2 foot under keel clearance, which is low on worldwide standard.
That's tight.
I think so.
And
yeah.
Although most of the river is deeper than the project, but you do have shoal areas that you have to time the tide or time the river level to make sure that you have that clearance. Currently, we're at a 42-foot level because we've had some shoaling and the snowpack is very low. We just didn't get the springtime runoff, so we're more at summertime. Early fall levels now, but we've just got some emergency dredging done, and that's been, and so we're looking at lifting that restriction shortly. The other problems are the fact that it's hard finding hopper dredges right now. They're busy or they're broke because and being worked on at this time. So.
Well, I, you know, the work that you and your colleagues do is absolutely invaluable, and it takes tremendous skill, I'm sure, to be able to do that. So I applaud your efforts at this. It's extremely important to us.
Well, thank you.
And are there any others?
I wanted to thank everybody who came today, and
yes.
It was, you kept our attention for almost 2 hours, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
And we really appreciate the fact that you drove all the way or came up this way to see us, and we promised to pass on all this good information to the rest of the representatives that couldn't be here today. So thank you.
So with that, thank you, sir. I'm going to close this informational hearing. And we are adjourned. So have a beautiful afternoon.
We're back. Not back till Monday.
Oh.
We're back. Not back till Monday.
Oh. So have a beautiful afternoon.